This is work that I did at Microsoft a few years back, and I want to really explain what I did, why I did it, and a few takeaways for game designers. As background for this work, Microsoft has been investing in structured security approaches for about 15 years. The threats to our products paper was 1999 was the first real attempt, and this really ties to the questions of workforce development. I don't know today's number, but we've got roughly 30,000 people who are involved in the creation of software at any given time. And while we have a tremendous number of security experts on staff, security folks can't be in every single meeting in which a decision is made. And so we need to give people a baseline knowledge about security so that they can make the decisions that they're able to make and that they can invoke experts when they need them. This Threats to Our Products paper introduced STRIDE, which is a mnemonic for some common threats that software faces. Spoofing, tampering, repudiation, information disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege. And I'll come back to STRIDE, but threat modeling and how we teach people threat modeling actually predates our security development lifecycle, which you might have heard about. And so my motivation for this work, for the game, is actually observing people threat modeling and talking to people who had tried to threat model in a variety of scenarios. And when those people were not security experts, they often seemed stymied by the advice that we give them. They would try to do it, they would put serious effort into it, and they would simply get stuck. And When we asked people who were steeped in security, who understand security, they created very interesting threat models. They thought about their problems. But we needed a way to get folks who are experts in networking, experts in database design, experts in things other than information security, some of this knowledge. And as I worked on the problem, my goal at the time, or my job at the time, was to make threat modeling better. I had a fairly broad remit. It was very nice. And I wanted to think about a way that was non-threatening. And non-threatening became a goal when someone came up to me after a class I taught and said, you know, I try and do this, but it just feels like such a crushing responsibility. If I make a mistake, our customers are going to experience all of this pain. Isn't there a way that I can hand this task to someone else so that I don't have to take that responsibility? And they were feeling that they were threatened by the things that we were asking them to do. And so non-threatening was my first goal. And then I thought about the conversations I was having, and I said, actually, I want to go further. I want to entice people into this task. I want them to feel like this is a good thing for them to be spending their time on, because there's a lot of things which they could be spending their time on. I think this is important, and if I think this is important, maybe I should do something to pull them in, not just tell them this is a good thing, but make them feel the same way. And I wanted something that was supportive, that helped people do these tasks that we were asking them to do. And one day I was listening to a podcast, and I heard Laurie Williams talking about protection poker. And I went and I looked up protection poker, and being young and foolish, I said, oh, I can do better than that. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into when I said that. And so my motivation for this talk is really to talk about what I went through, inform future game designers, because really I got very, very lucky in a lot of ways as I was creating Elevation of Privilege, and I had no idea how many ways I was getting lucky as I was creating the game. But I'm a big fan of this Louis Pasteur quote that fortune favors the prepared mind. And so if you're going to go and do this, a little bit of preparation can be helpful. So briefly, what is the elevation of privilege game? As I have waved around, it's a card game that Microsoft gives away. The game mechanic is borrowed from a no-bid spades. So you play in tricks or hands, the high card wins, there's a trump suit, and in spades, that trump suit being spades, in elevation of privilege, the trump suit is elevation of privilege because I decided to use as suits those stride threats. And so each card, as you can see, has a number, it has a suit, such as tampering, and it says something like, an attacker can replay data without detection because your code doesn't provide timestamps or sequence numbers. And that's a hint. It's a instantiation of a tampering threat that you might experience, because the way the game is played is that you draw a picture on a whiteboard and then you deal out these cards, and then people connect the threats on the cards to what's on the whiteboard. And this seems to work in terms of supportive and helpful. So as a prototype, when I started, this is from the very first playtest that we did, and you'll notice that there's a suit and a hint that's on the card already. You might also notice there's space on the cards for recording what you do or what you discovered. And that's an interesting mechanic, because it means that one deck gets used once and then you can't use it again. And that's a really poor choice. But it was a prototype, and as we were designing, we realized that people would want to keep these. They wouldn't want to use them once. Another thing that you can see on these is these threats are about you. And the way in which we constructed the hints turned out to be one of the most difficult parts of the design. Is it about you? We ended up with an attacker, the less threatening, the less intimidating wording. We also had a system which was much more prominent in the early training about how to play the game of riffing, that people could go and say, oh, that threat makes me think of this thing and this makes me think of this thing. And it turns out that non-experts didn't do that, that the people who the game was targeted at never made use of that mechanic, and it added tremendous complexity throughout the game. Similarly, there was complex scoring that we seemed to support game goals. As I ran playtests, as I had people do this thing, what I discovered was that at the end of each hand, they would turn to me and say, Adam, who gets how many points? And I realized that I wasn't going to be in the box, and so that was a bad mechanic, because it wasn't actually working. There were, as always, a bunch of design trade-offs. One is card size. These are larger than standard playing cards. The reason for that is twofold. The first is I wanted people to get their laptops out of the way. I'd seen that in playtests. I wanted to encourage it. The second reason is I wanted people to, if you will, put their cards on the table. When they put their cards on the table, because they're not easy to hold in your hand, we saw people helping one another through the course of the game. The more experienced people, the ones with a little more security knowledge, would offer advice to the ones who were not experienced. And so the larger card size turns out to be a feature. There were a bunch of, and Zach's used the gamification word. I don't think of this as gamification. I think of this as a game with a purpose. And we avoided, there was heavy pressure inside the company to do some online thing with points and badges and leaderboards or something so that we could measure what we were getting, what people were doing. And I didn't feel that it spoke to the authenticity of the game, that if there was a mechanism that forced people to get online and then go back offline, it detracted from other goals, and so we ended up not doing that. The construction of the hints turned out to be one of the hardest things. We had, at the start, a set of hints in the threat modeling tool, software tool that we had created. Assigning point values to those, constructing the words, deciding which of those hints that were in the tool made it into the game was a complex and challenging set of tasks because we didn't really have a way to evaluate them. As I'm sure many of you know, we don't really talk about the security incidents which we have in the real world. And so the natural goal of doing a frequency-driven or impact-driven assignment of those hints simply wasn't feasible. Another trade-off was depth and breadth. I mentioned the riffing system, which was really designed to help people go deep into the threats they were seeing. And as a security person, it was very attractive to me to have such a mechanism. When I thought about it from a let's teach people perspective, it turned out that breadth was much more important. Go through your system as a whole, understand the system as a whole. And so we mostly eliminated that. I've talked about the value of physical cards in terms of the social and around the table. The other trade-off I want to mention again is we spent some money, I think it was in the thousands of dollars, to do graphic design on these. And when I think back to my experience with the print 'em yourself business cards and telling people about the game versus watching what happens when we give these away at trade shows and whatnot, and people will come up and say, can I have 6 or can I have 10? A friend of mine sent me a picture of his 2-year-old playing with the cards. Someone else told me that his 8-year-old had tried to hack his brother's Minecraft password after flipping through the cards. I think the fact that and there's interesting ethical questions, which I'm going to bypass there, but the fact that the cards are attractive to a 2-year-old or to an 8-year-old, maybe to unusual 2-year-olds or 8-year-olds, but that degree of attractiveness is, while it's easy to put a price tag on, it's hard to explain how valuable it is. There were a few aspects of serendipity, things that I didn't expect, and the first of those is the game is actually far more popular outside of Microsoft than inside. And there's a bunch of pithy ways of saying that play is the opposite of work, you can't force someone to play, and I think that's really a key part of this, that of the popularity outside. We still ask everyone to threat model. We use the game in training inside the company. When I talk to people elsewhere in industry, the game is being used in a bunch of places to actually do threat modeling. They pull it out on a regular basis. They go through and they threat model the things they're building. When introducing the game, I found that asking people to suspend skepticism, I apologize for the edit issue there, asking people to suspend their skepticism. There are people who don't believe that games belong at work. And if I say, I'd like you to suspend disbelief for 15 minutes and give this a shot, those people generally are willing to give me 15 minutes of their time. And at the end of that 15 minutes, they're generally willing to give me a lot more of it. So learning that question was a big win. Another explanation for the game being more popular outside of Microsoft than inside of Microsoft, my colleague Ross Smith has a paper in which he defines the scenarios in which games can be successful at work. And he says learning is one of those circumstances. Core job skills that you expect of everyone, it's harder to create games to help with those or to gamify them. Another element of serendipity is that the game, if you play through Elevation of Privilege with a real system you're designing, you end up with a real threat model for that system. That the game actually has this result. It teaches you along the way. But if I had known how hard that was to do when I set out to do it, I never would have tried. So there was some serendipity there. And with that, I'm happy to take questions you might have.
I've noticed in labs that if we sort of open up the labs, that students will lean on, weaker students will lean on more skilled students to get through their labs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the learning experience of the weaker students is then lessened as a result of this leaning on the stronger students. And sometimes students will actually manipulate and try to get other people to do their labs for them. So have you any evidence that having the cards laid out on the table might just result in a worse working learning experience for the less experienced rather than, or any learning experience, if the people who are trying to brag and be, you know, sort of the cyber experts, just do this for them and say, do it here, do what, I'll do it for you.
Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting question, and I would baseline a little bit differently in the work environment than in the school environment, where someone will go through some sort of test or assessment. Because what I've seen before we had a game, and one of the things that I didn't talk about is the game nature, the play in hands forcing everyone to participate, really exposes that some people don't understand the material. And that's not something we would necessarily see at work. Someone might bargain and say, hey, can you take on this threat modeling task while I write up the feature spec? And so that exposure, yep, they will lean on other people. The other thing I would mention, though, is there's a lot of educational work on having students teaching other students forces the older student to learn the material better, because to teach it, you need to understand it. And the younger student getting a less intimidating educational experience. And I think there's an excellent question there of how do all of those factors play out and how could we rigorously evaluate them. So I'm not going to pretend to have an answer on the rigorous side, but I think there's different ways you could analyze it before you do.
Zachary Peterson, Cal Poly. So EOP is one of the oldest games in this non-digital space, Protection Poker being another. I have kind of a broad question, which is, what has been your experience trying to make research out of EOP? Like, what do you think are the right questions? Like, there seems like a broad array of things you could ask. What have you thought about?
So it's an interesting question, and I should be clear that I'm in Microsoft Trustworthy Computing, not in Microsoft Research. And so my day job is not publishing papers, it's not doing research, it's helping people inside and outside of Microsoft build more secure things, operate more secure things. I would really like to be able to say, to go from the anecdote to some sort of rigorous statement about this is the learning curve with EOP versus this is the learning curve with the software tool that we've created, or this is the learning curve in other circumstances, because anecdotally, it's very strong. I'd like to go beyond that. I don't know how to do that because it's not my skill set or my focus.
Hi. So as I'm sure you know, Yoshi Kono's group has created a set of threat modeling cards as well.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they've made different design decisions. I was wondering whether you had any comments about what those differences in design decisions are and sort of what sort of approach would he use and what kind of circumstances?
I was not aware that they have published. I've talked to Yoshi through several prototype iterations, but I don't want to speak for him. My understanding of those cards is that they're much more on the order of like the Van Ox focused brainstorming cards, and there's less of a play mechanism, but I'm not sure if that's the final product that they've released.
Yeah, at least the version I have is that's exactly that.
They don't
have very much rules about it, and it's sort of suggesting sort of freeform play.
So, you know, that would be a fascinating research question, is you give one deck to one group, one deck to the other group, what do they come up with? Then you get into the question of what should they come up with, right? Mm-hmm. What is the desirable outcome from one of these exercises, how that feeds into the next stage, and how that might feed into the next stage of a research project might be very different from how it feeds into the next stage of a software development project. With a research project, you might say, oh, we're going to make these changes because we learned these interesting things. With a software development project, you might say, we need to make these two key design changes, then we need to mitigate these other things. And so the outcome of one is much more knowledge, the outcome of the other, much more actionable, what I think of as bugs. And I'd be interested if that's actually the case. I'd be interested in, you know, independent expert evaluation of this set looks like it's more useful. I think there's a bunch of evaluation which you could do, and I think that would be fun.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that occurred to me is that, as you said, companies really, really hate the word game, and that it taking away the rules like they did might make it more accessible. But who knows?
It is a great hypothesis. I would love to see it tested.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you, Adam.
All right. Thank you.